Hey, this is Shale. I just wanted to take care of a little housekeeping before we get into our fifth episode of Food Court. We didn't really know what to expect when we started recording this podcast, and I suppose in a roundabout way it occurred to us that we might wind up having people listen to it. But I think I'm speaking for both Alan and I when I say that the response has defied our expectations. We seem to have a really solid base of super loyal listeners, of which you are obviously one. I just wanted to start the show today with a little message for you, our loyal listener. Firstly, I'd like to humbly thank you for taking the chance to spend some time listening to us. It really means a lot. It's always been a fun idea for us to record a podcast of our kitchen chats, but knowing someone is getting some enjoyment out of it is the cherry on top of the pineapple upside down cake. Or I guess it would be on the bottom. Second, if you've been listening to the show and enjoying it, that's enough for us. However, if you feel like giving a little bit back, consider leaving us a review in Apple Podcasts. It really helps more people discover the podcast. And thirdly, we'd love to start incorporating listener feedback or answers to listener questions into the format of the show. It might still be a few episodes away, but it's always been something that was a part of the plan. If you have thoughts or opinions about the topics on the show, or are curious about our opinions on something else, please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm. We'd love to hear from you, and we'd love for the show to become a little more interactive as it develops. Now, let's get to the good stuff.
We did have a fire outside today, though. We had hot dogs and s'mores.
Oh, cool.
Do you want to know the most chefy thing that I do? Like,
yeah.
Like, kind of like grown, like cringeworthy chefy thing.
Uh-huh.
S'mores. Like, I use regular graham crackers and regular marshmallows and Lindt 70% dark chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
But I always bring Malden salt.
Oh yeah.
To put on the s'more when we're having a campfire.
Yeah, you need that. Have you ever tasted a graham cracker? Holy shit.
The salt, yeah, I don't know. The salt really just, this is super douchey. It just elevates it so much. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, it really does elevate it. Oh, man, that is such a good word. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sutterby.
Hi.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. So let's get chatting. I have something to follow up with you about. I think it was in our last episode. Oh yeah, because it was in the how would you make this conversation.
Okay, yep.
You used the word stodgy a couple times.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Stodgy means like heavy and cumbersome.
Huh. Okay, yeah, interesting.
Is that what it means? Is that not what it means?
I don't know that that probably is what it means. Just like to me, I think it means like old and out of touch or something. I don't know. Like
Yeah, I could see that being one. Yeah, I could see that fitting too.
Another like connotative meaning of it or something. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think sometimes I often use it referring to, like if you're referring to the texture of food, stodgy is like, yeah, heavy and glommy. And is glommy a word? I don't know. I think that like...
I mean, I understand what you mean when you say glommy. Well, and I understood what you meant when you said stodgy too, but I just, yeah, like...
But you're right.
I don't think that I have used that word in that context. So.
Right. If you're describing a person as stodgy, I think that what you, like your definition makes much more sense.
Right. Interesting.
I'm going to look into that.
Okay, so what? We're on a podcast? Oh, yeah. Okay.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, we do have two amazing topics planned for today.
Yeah. Actually, I'm super excited.
All right. My topic, which we, shortly before we started recording, we decided we were going to do first, is what's your favorite food movie? So that's fun. And I guess we'll see if we have anything to say about it.
Yeah.
Oh, I say that before we start every conversation, I noticed.
Oh, is that right? So it can go
I
on.
I always
the...
say, I hope we have something to talk about.
So that goes on Turns the like do. The drinking game list.
You know, the yeah, food... that goes on the drinking game list. Okay. Exactly. Every time I say, oh boy, I hope that we have something to say. And Alan, what's your topic?
At some point, we're going to talk about guilty food pleasures.
I'm excited for that too. Well, we kind of talked about it already, and I sort of expressed my like apprehension about it,
right.
Because I feel like your guilty pleasures are going to be much more wholesome than mine. But I guess we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
We'll see.
Okay. Well, Alan.
Yeah.
What's your favorite food movie?
Well,
do you want to do yours first?
Well, okay, so to start, when you first proposed the idea, I was like, oh, that's such a great idea. As soon as I started thinking about it, I realized there's not actually, at least in my world, very many movies that are like about and dedicated to food. There's a lot of really great food scenes in movies, but mm-hmm. The list that I wrote, the kind of short list that I wrote when I was trying to pick one, was not very long, really only a handful. Is that, am I way off the mark or?
No, I think you're right. Like movies that are centered around food.
Yeah.
There aren't really tons of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's really famous food scenes like mm-hmm. the Goodfellas prison sauce scene.
Oh man. Yeah. That's a good one.
That's just but like,
yeah, become... Goodfellas does not count as a food movie.
No, of course not. And I always think of like the strudel scene in Inglourious Basterds. I don't know if you remember that.
I don't remember it at all.
There's a scene where Shoshana is
right.
having.
Oh, sorry. They're having dinner in the restaurant, and yeah, no, I do remember.
Yeah, and Colonel Landa kind of like forces her to stay longer than she's comfortable doing, so that she can right. eat schnitzel or sorry, not schnitzel, strudel.
Strudel with cream.
Yeah, and he makes her wait for the cream, and it's an extremely nerve-wracking scene because you're starting to wonder if he knows her real identity because she grew up on a dairy farm. I don't know. Anyways, so there's lots of these like yeah, really exactly. great. Tidbits, food tidbits from movies. But yeah, my list of like movies that are about food, I had like Ratatouille, Babette's Feast, mm-hmm. Chef.
I've never heard of Ratatouille.
and I don't even know what else.
Oh, you had three only?
Yeah, as my short list of like movies that I really enjoy that are wholesale about food or cooking.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I can think of a few more off the top of my head. The Big Night. Yeah, The Big Night is really awesome. Love it a lot. It's about two Italian brothers who try to open an Italian restaurant in Jersey?
Okay. I
can't remember, actually. Anyway, they throw a big feast at the end, and it's awesome.
Cool.
You said Chef. What's that movie where Adam Sandler plays Thomas Keller or something? Do you know what I'm talking
about? That wasn't a joke?
No. Well, no. Oh.
There's one with Bradley Cooper.
Spanglish.
Oh,
am I crazy?
Yeah, the last Adam Sandler movie I saw. I haven't seen Spanglish. Is he's a chef?
Yeah, he's a chef. I don't think the whole movie... If I'm remembering correctly, I don't think the whole movie is centered around food, but he is a chef and like he's a fine dining chef. And there's a scene in the movie where he makes like I think he gets home from work and he makes a croque monsieur mm-hmm. something. And it's like Keller's style. And like it's this thing that Keller's talked about several times and that he's actually like made on camera before and stuff.
Oh, really?
And then Thomas Keller was like a food consultant, I believe, for that movie. And then he taught Adam Sandler how to make the sandwich.
Oh, really? Because he was also a consultant on Ratatouille, right?
Yes. Yeah, he is. At least for the, I don't know, like, I don't really know off the top of my head, like how much he consulted on like the overall cooking in the movie,
right?
But definitely for the dish that gets served at the Ratatouille dish that yeah. gets served at the end.
Okay, it's we're like, we're there. Let's just Shale, is your favorite food movie Ratatouille?
Yeah.
Tell me.
So my favorite food movie is Ratatouille.
Why?
Which might be kind of weird because it's a Disney Pixar movie, but I don't know. I just, obviously there's a lot of dumb stuff about it. There's a lot of dumb stuff in it.
Like what? You mean the talking rats?
Well, I mean, sort of. There's a lot of accurate sort of like cooking culture and restaurant culture, but then there's also a lot of dumb tropes that,
okay,
you know, that they kind of lean on because that's, you know, like one of the biggest ones for me is like the head chef in the restaurant that this takes place in, at mm-hmm. least at the beginning of the movie. The head chef is like this real like nasty, mean, like angry,
yeah,
mustache twisting, like
he's a villain
jerk, yeah, chef with like, yeah, a small man complex or something. Yeah, I don't totally know. And they kind of lean on that pretty hard. And there's a few other things in it like that, that I'm kind of like, yeah, that I sort of like roll my eyes at a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And even like, I think the character of the critic, Anton Ego,
yes,
is like, for most of the movie, he's like a really bad trope of a critic.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a caricature of a critic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is obviously like, it's on purpose to make it, you know, like, and to give him this like really kind of like, I don't know, demonic edge or something. Like,
but I almost think that it's done tongue in cheek, I think, like, especially with Anton Ego, when he, like, the mm-hmm. way he thinks of himself and the way he talks about food is so over the top. To me, it's a parody of food critics, or a satire rather, right, I guess. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it definitely is, but it just like feels a little bit heavy handed to me.
Okay.
Because like the thing that I, you know, love about the movie is, one of the things that I love about the movie is that, you know, in the end, he has this food experience that makes him remember what food was like when he was a child.
Yes.
And it just like completely changes his personality and, you know, allows him to fall back in love with like the culture that, you know, I guess he probably was in love with before he, you know, became a critic and then subsequently became jaded or whatever. And then, mm-hmm. and then he can like actually enjoy eating and enjoy dining and have fun, you know, going out and drinking a glass of wine again by the end of the movie, which to me seems like, you know, but at the end of the movie, he seems like a real character. The beginning of right. the movie, he seems like just a caricature, which,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. But it's a real, he has kind of an Ebenezer Scrooge-esque transformation, right? Like he,
yeah, exactly,
really dour. But
I think in the case of Ebenezer Scrooge at the end, he's also a caricature. He's just like too crazy happy, you know, or right. something. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, also what's dumb but is also hilarious is like how there's, you know, the idea that like Remy the rat can just control Linguini by pulling his hair.
Okay. I knew you were bringing Ratatouille to the table and I love the movie, mm-hmm. but the first time that I saw it, that was almost a deal breaker for me. I almost stopped watching it.
I hear you.
And I know like it's a kid's movie ostensibly and there's talking yeah. rats, but like that's dumb. It doesn't make any sense within the world they've created at all that you can control someone's limbs by pulling on their hair. It's
by pulling whatever. Their hair. Yeah,
no. It sets up some great physical comedy and stuff, but like it's really dumb.
Yeah, that's just it. I mean, like, it's funny, though, because, like, the first time I watched it, I think I kind of noticed that. I was like, okay, this is dumb. But then the physical comedy that they use, that they, like, use that to then, like, illustrate is mm-hmm. so hilarious that I think that I didn't really think about it too much.
Right, yeah.
I was just, like, thinking it was hilarious, but then, yeah. On a couple subsequent watches, I'm just like, come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and like, it's also just like really, you know, like it's kind of dumb how like, you know, he can control him to the, like they practice obviously or whatever, but then he can control him to the extent where he's just like doing this like kitchen ballet. That's like, so,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
graceful, and he's just doing like 18 things at once, and everything's just like,
right.
And he never even cuts himself. I thought about that the whole time. Actually, this time when I watched it, I was like, yeah, nobody gets cut. Nobody gets burned in that whole movie.
There are so many details to that movie that are just spot on. And the way they talk about food generally is really great. Like most of the things that Colette says, the lone woman in the kitchen, and later on the love interest, unfortunately. She talks about working clean and mise en place, and and she talks about what it's like to be the only woman in the kitchen at one point, which I thought was kind of cool.
That's kind of like my favorite scene with her, actually. Like when, you know, like she sort of gets assigned to take him under her wing, and she's like kind of annoyed, and he saunters over like, I don't know, like he's going to charm her or something, like, you know. And she just like starts pulling knives out of her knife block and like pinning his coat to the cutting board with them, and just like gives him a lecture about, you know, how she's obviously the toughest cook in the kitchen.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite scenes with her. I think it's great.
There's lots of gems with her. But this, like their first kiss where she has the mace, she's pulled mace out of her purse and she's like deciding whether or not she's going to spray mace in his eyes or continue kissing him. I really like that scene.
I like it too, although the kiss that he plants on her, well, it's not really his intention to do it. The rat makes him do it.
Right.
Remy makes him do it. But I was like, I don't know. It seems to me now watching it, I don't think I ever thought this before, but it seems to me now watching it that, like, you know, if she was considering whether to mace him or not, the minute he like planted a kiss on her without any kind of consent, probably would have been the moment when she decided, yes, I'm macing this guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was a little disappointed that she didn't mace him this time around, but
we've changed the story a lot. But anyway, there's loads of color and detail that is just really great. To me, like the scene when Ego tastes the ratatouille and is transported back to his childhood, I think that has like become ingrained in the minds of cooks forever now. Like that's something that you can say to probably to most people, but certainly to cooks, like when you say that scene in Ratatouille, they know what you're talking about. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, it really strikes a chord for me. And like, without that scene, it's not my favorite food movie.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
That scene is what makes the movie. It's like so well done. It's not even long.
No, like, no, it's not at all.
You know, like there's a lot of buildup for it, but then it's basically one bite and then you're transported to, you know, him coming in. I don't know, like looks like maybe he's been injured or he's sad about something. He's coming in the door and he's crying and his mom makes him a bowl of ratatouille, and then he's there just like with this comfort food and his mom, and they're like, I haven't watched that movie and watched that scene and not cried. So
yeah,
like every time I know it's coming, I know what it is, I know what to expect, but it just really hits home for me, because to me, that's the thing about food and cooking that fuels my passion for it.
Mm-hmm.
Like in myself, remembering, you know, like I'm not really a nostalgic person, but like food memories really, you know, really hit my nostalgia buttons.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, that for me is like probably the biggest thing about food and cooking that, you know, makes it a passion for me and makes me feel like I can never tire of it. You know, like,
right, yeah,
I might get tired of certain aspects of it, but like, I'm always fascinated with it. I always want to continue learning in it. And like, I think that's the reason why, is because I can, like, it provides that experience for me, but then it also, you know, allows me to try to provide that experience for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it's not like saving lives or heart surgery or anything like that, you mm-hmm. know. It's kind of frivolous, but at the same time, it's like a really solid way to communicate with people on, you know, on a level where, you know, you're not just, you know, it's kind of hard to like just in conversation or just like, you know, getting to know people, you know, it's hard to connect like on a deep level, but I think that food is one of those things that can really help you connect with people on a deep level.
Absolutely.
So that's why it's my favorite food movie, is because I think that, you know, Brad Bird, who's the director, and I think a lot of other people probably who worked on it really understand that about the experience of food. And then they use it to like say a lot of other things about our culture and sort of like bring these disparate parts of the culture together in the end around that sort of shared experience. So there's a lot of stuff in the movie too that's sort of like kind of hidden, but is about like classism and stuff like that. There's a lot of dialogue in the movie that's like, you know, about like Remy being disgusted that his family can't appreciate food and things like that. And
right. Yeah.
He's sort of always silently judging them and they're always kind of silently judging him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, there's assumptions that people make about Linguini, and there's, you know, and there's like a lot of stuff that happens in the kitchen scenes where, you know, there are cooks within the hierarchy that look down on, you know, the new guy and stuff like that. Yeah. And, you know, the chef treats Linguini like garbage or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, like the sort of philosophy of Gusteau, the original chef of the restaurant, his philosophy is anyone can cook.
Right.
And they sort of like explore that, which is sort of like a statement about class, I think, or something. Anyways.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really love that movie.
It's the transporting back in time scene. Actually, it's funny. It makes me, in the French Laundry cookbook, Thomas Keller quotes one of his mentors, Roland Hanet, who says that if you're a really good cook, you can go back in time. That's the quote, which I like almost dropped the book the first time I read that. It just like hit me so hard over the head. Like, what a thought. But yeah, it's food and smells and tastes, like their ability to transport you back to that memory or whatever it is so remarkable. I don't know if I've told you this before, but I had this experience. I had this experience in so the Elm Catering Kitchen, the one on 115th Street. So it was like a big warehouse that had been we'd built the catering kitchen into. And it was in the summertime, it was just like always 30 degrees in that kitchen. There was not much you could do about it. There was no AC, but there was like a big bay door in the back, and we could open that bay door and open a door up the front. And so you'd get like a bit of a cross breeze. So like this warm draft coming through the kitchen to kind of cool you down.
Mm-hmm.
And when the wind blew through the kitchen, all of the like catering menus and prep lists that were hung on clipboards and bulletin boards would start fluttering. Okay. And so I'm in the kitchen cutting chickens, and I'm kind of downwind from someone who's slicing fennel.
Oh yeah.
Like fresh fennel bulb. And so I've got this warm breeze and these fluttering papers, and then just like this really powerful aroma of anise, like from the fennel. And it like not as dramatic or had with the emotional impact as the last part of Ratatouille, but it like took me back to this one moment that was probably 10 years before that, where Lisa and I had got into a hotel we were staying at in Greece very late at night. It was really warm out. This warm rushing breeze, like it was a really windy night. And while they were preparing our room, they sat us in a lime orchard and served us ouzo. And so like warm wind,
oh my God,
fluttering whatever lime tree leaves, and like the smell of ouzo, leaves, like that anise. And it was just like, I probably was totally zoned out for whatever 5 seconds, but I was just like back in that lime orchard from these like this. It was mostly these kind of like the sensual cues, like the warm air and the smell of anise, and yeah, especially with unique aromas like that. I find them like you're just instantly taken back to whatever your association is. But yeah,
that's amazing. Yeah, I have some ones like that too. One of my like strongest food memories, which isn't like even, well, I guess it was almost a decade ago. When I was in France, I was like, went on this bike ride with a friend of mine, and like we were biking along a canal and we like scooted off the canal for a minute and we were just like biking into this like little section of a town. It was near Toulouse. It's in pretty southern France. And yeah, we like scooched off the path and like biking through this like kind of little town. And there was a little kind of like a house on a big lot that had like a big garden. And there was a fig tree that a whole bunch of the branches were like hanging over the fence into the road. And, you know, I know you're not really supposed to go and pick fruit off somebody else's tree.
No.
But they just looked so amazing. And so we each took one and it was just like unbelievable. Like it was the best piece of fruit I probably ever had in my life.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, like every time I smell figs now, I'm just like back there immediately. I can remember everything about it.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So Ratatouille, that's my fave. I'm also like a big kind of like Pixar fanboy. So
yeah. Well, fair enough.
Yeah. It's like not that surprising. But I really also like Remy's character. Like, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous that he winds up running a restaurant by the end of the movie. Like, that's obviously pretty stupid. But he goes on a journey too. He has to, you know, at the beginning, he's pretty naive about, like, you know, what he may or may not be able to accomplish. And he winds up accomplishing more than you would ever think that he possibly could.
Right.
But he also, you know, learns that he doesn't just deserve to have everything happen to him. He has to also, like, you know, he also has to cooperate with Linguini, and they get mad at each other and they break up, and then you know Ego shows up and they got to get the band back together. I don't know.
Yeah.
I really dig it.
I like his arc, like just as a chef, I think is interesting as a rat chef. Like going from having to control Linguini to like make specific dishes and kind of like be doing the work himself to the last service you see them do, or sorry, the service where they're serving Ego. He's actually being a chef. He's not really doing any cooking. He's doing a lot of tasting and organizing, and he kind of commandeers the kitchen. And it reminds me
if only
of, like,
it was as easy as he makes it look.
He's a natural.
He puts all the rats through the dishwasher and then he's like, okay, you rats go to the sauce station. Like they know what the sauce station is.
Yeah. I don't know. Just like, but that is like you know what I mean? Like
he's a really good chef.
As a career arc, like it happens over the course of, it happens very rapidly for him.
But yeah, totally.
That's something like Grant Achatz talks about a lot. Cause when he lost his tongue and like wasn't able to cook and taste in the usual way, but like that is what he says, like finally pushed him into the like actually running the kitchen as a chef and not trying to micromanage and do everything himself
and be a cook every day and be the one who's like got his hands in every component of every dish that they're preparing. That's another amazing story that we should talk about at some point.
Grant Achatz.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't really read too much about him lately, honestly. Like, I haven't really heard too much about him in, like, in the last few years. But, I mean, Alinea's still open.
Right.
And Next is as well, I think. So,
Yeah.
So, Ratatouille. Now everybody knows that's my favorite food movie.
It's good. It's
what
a great.
What about you, Alan?
Okay, so I'm bringing Babette's Feast to this conversation. I don't know if I can truly say casually that it's my absolute favorite food movie of all time, but it's excellent. And I feel like there's just loads to talk about in it.
Yeah, totally.
So you've seen it. You saw it ages ago and you recently rewatched it.
That's right. Yeah, so I pretty much, well, I had... Like when you brought it up, like I've heard of it plenty, but when you initially brought it up, I was like, oh, I don't think I've seen it. But then when we started talking about it, I was like, oh yeah, I have seen it. And now I remember where, when I was living and working on the Sunshine Coast, a friend of mine, Madeline, who was working at the same restaurant that I was, it was like one of her favorite movies.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I watched it with her. I'm pretty sure. either I watched it with her or she recommended that I watch it and then I did or something. So that was a long time ago. That was, let's not think about it. And then I don't know if I watched it again in between, but then I watched it today. Right. Alan, so it's real fresh in my memory.
So the, like, I assume it's not as well known as Ratatouille to most people who are alive right now. So the kind of like, if you were giving an elevator pitch for it, it would be something like a opulent, lavish haute cuisine French meal is prepared for a group of elderly, curmudgeonly, austere Lutherans or something like that. Like that's kind of what
that's
the,
a pretty good description.
That's what, if you were selling it in the elevator, that's what you would say. There is a plot. It's I don't know. Do we need a brief synopsis to continue this conversation or?
Maybe we should talk about it. I was going to say that, like, I think that the Hollywood pitch for it, like, have you ever seen The Player?
No.
Okay. Well, in The Player, there's a bunch of like there's writers who are always pitching stories. It's a movie about Hollywood.
Okay.
And there's writers who are like always pitching stories, and they pitch stories by saying it's like this movie meets this movie.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So I think that like Babette's Feast is like, it's Footloose meets Cocoon meets Dogville.
I understand the Footloose and the Cocoon bits. I don't know what Dogville is.
So Dogville. Yeah, I knew that was going to be too obscure. Dogville is this like weirdly staged movie by a Danish director. What's his name? Actually, I don't even think it's in Danish though. So maybe not Dogville, but it's definitely Footloose meets Cocoon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sort of.
So I hope this makes sense to people. Like
but in the kitchen.
It takes place in a very remote Danish village in the latter part of the 19th century. There are two sisters who run or kind of are the head of this religious group that's very austere, and they spurn any like worldly pleasures, basically. Like they don't like things to be sensual or lavish or
right. It's
anything.
Like puritanical.
Yeah. So that's the Footloose connection. It's like no dance,
right, exactly.
No dancing. Like to the point that they've even though they had many suitors in their youth, they chose not to marry because they thought it would distract them from their service to God, basically.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and the two women are daughters of this like
the
preacher.
Yeah. The founder of the,
yeah.
Yeah.
Of their like kind of Lutheran sect,
yeah.
Or whatever.
So he's now deceased. And so they're presiding over this religious group that's now like very like increasingly elderly, and they're not getting any new converts or anything. So that's the Cocoon element, right?
The Cocoon element is that they're elderly and they feel, yeah, curmudgeonly, but then they have this experience that reawakens their youthful nature.
Right. I see. Yeah. And so the experience comes from Babette. Babette is basically like a refugee from Paris. Like there was a bunch of violence in Paris after the Franco-Prussian War. And so she had to flee Paris, and through an interesting backstory that we don't need to explain, she ends up in this small village and kind of working for room and board, but nothing else, just to have a place to stay for the with these two women. And she stays with them for many, many years. And then she wins the lottery, literally, which sounds like a cheap storytelling trick, but that's what happens. There's a nice story to the lottery
in the
ticket.
Movie also, I noticed today that it really did feel like a cheap storytelling trick.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of hilarious, actually. There's like one thing in the whole movie to set it up, and that's that like she goes to the post office one day and she goes to the like the grocery store, and she, well, the, the postman and the grocer in this town are the same person.
Yeah,
so
that's right,
yeah. She goes to the grocery store and she talks to the postman, and she tells him that she has no connection to France anymore whatsoever, except a friend of hers who renews a lottery ticket for her every year.
Yes.
So it's kind of funny. Like, there's just like one line in the movie that sets it up. And then, yeah, like a few scenes later, she wins the lottery. I thought it was pretty funny. Yeah.
It's, I don't know, to me, like if there had been a little bit more about, like, it sounds like it could be a charming story. It's like, she's never expecting to go back to France, or she's not expecting to be able to go back to France. But this one friend, as this kind of like never give up hope, renews this lottery ticket for her every year. So it could be a charming backstory. It is kind of glossed over until she actually just literally wins the lottery.
Yeah.
And so everyone kind of assumes that she's taking all this money and moving back to France. And Babette asks the two sisters if before she goes, she can prepare for them and their congregation a French dinner to commemorate, to thank them. But it's on the surface, it's to commemorate the 100th birthday of their deceased father.
Yeah, that's right. Like, it's sort of the way it works out is that, like, they're already planning to have this commemorative ceremony for their father.
Yes.
And then she, you know, to like honor them and to honor their father, asks, you know, permission to prepare a French meal.
Yes.
For,
and the sisters agree, but as Babette collects, she sends someone to Paris, her nephew or something, to Paris to collect ingredients. And then the ingredients arrive in the small town and are kind of like marched through the city. And they include like a cage of live quails and a live turtle and like the most
live sea turtle, like a live gigantic sea turtle,
and some of the most famous and expensive wines in the world, and black truffles and foie gras. And then the sisters and their congregation start to get a little bit, they're worried that this is going to be too decadent. Like sinfully decadent.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And they still agree to, they still, out of respect to Babette, they still all agree to have the meal, but they make this weird kind of condition that none of them will actually speak of the food as they're eating it, because they don't want to give in to the temptation and enjoy the food, basically.
Yeah.
So there's this weird energy where they're eating the food and they're not talking about it. But thankfully, there's this kind of last minute addition to the guest list. And it's this worldly Swedish general, like a military officer, who has lived in Paris and knows all about this food. And he's like giving this running commentary of the meal and explaining how exquisite it is to the townspeople.
Yeah, somewhat boorishly at first, it seems like, because you know, they're all trying to like keep the discussion about the preacher, and they're all trying to really focus on not giving into their enjoyment of the food, and he's he wasn't really briefed about that whole aspect of the dinner, so he's just like enjoying himself and drinking the wine and just like, you know, and having his mind blown by the food and just like openly discussing it. And every time he like, he's like saying a lot of things just sort of like generally to the table. But a few times he like, you know, looks people in the eye and addresses them and asks them if they're enjoying the wine or enjoying the dish. And they just talk about the weather.
Yes. It's I love all of the, cause even though we've gone over the whole plot, like there's so many details in the relationships between the people who are at the table that do make it a really interesting dinner to watch. But like, just see, it's just such a fantastic glimpse into like the haute cuisine of the late 19th century, like stuff that you would see in opulent hotels and restaurants in Paris. And to see, like to see the live quails be carted into the kitchen, and then you see them plucked and cut open, like, and stuffed with foie and black truffle. So that dish in the movie is caille en sarcophage.
Yeah, caille en sarcophage.
So it's like quails in a sarcophagus.
Yeah.
And so the birds are stuffed with the foie and truffles, and they're put into a little kind of puff pastry, like a vol-au-vent kind of thing, and then baked and served with some kind of sauce.
Yeah, with their feet sticking out one end and their heads sticking out the other end.
Yeah. And so I don't know, I tried to find that dish. Like I looked in La Russe Gastronomique to see if that was a real dish or if it was made up for the movie or what. It's not mentioned in La Russe.
Uh-huh.
When you Google it, only Babette comes up. But I would think that it's probably taken from real life, but I don't know.
Well, I'm not sure either. Like they may have taken it like from a restaurant menu or something,
mm-hmm.
but in the movie, is it okay if I spoil the twist?
I think that, okay, so this movie was made in 1987. Surely the statute of limitation on spoiler alerts and stuff has run its course. So yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I totally agree with that. And also, I wouldn't really call it much of a twist. I think what constituted a twist in 1987 was a lot less sort of like, you know, like, I don't know. I feel like the twist endings nowadays are much more aggressive than they were.
Yeah. Well, M. Night Shyamalan changed everything, right? So.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man.
So the twist?
So the twist is, turns out that before she left Paris, she was the head chef at a restaurant, what was considered to be one of the best restaurants in Paris. It was called Café de l'Anglais, I think.
Café Anglais, yeah. And that was a real restaurant.
Oh, really?
So I don't know. Yeah. So I don't, and that, like, that is in La Russe, like, because La Russe will list all of the, like, they have entries for all the, like, most famous Parisian restaurants, like Voisin and stuff like that. So Café Anglais is in there. They don't mention.
So like maybe the dish is actually taken from a Café Anglais menu or something.
That'd be cool.
But yeah, like in the movie, it turns out that she was the head chef at this restaurant, and the general had been invited to a dinner at the restaurant where he had that dish.
Yeah,
and it was like prepared exactly the same way, and so you know he never wound up meeting Babette. I don't think so.
No.
Right. Yeah. So there was no like real way for him to actually put two and two together.
Mm-hmm.
But they made it seem like it was her dish. Like,
yes.
You know, her like signature dish,
yeah.
If you would call it that or something. So, you know, she prepared it at the restaurant and then, you know, it was one of her favorites. And so she brought it out for this feast that they have. But so I like, it doesn't surprise me that it's not like in La Russe or something, because they make it seem like it was like her creation something in the movie, you know. So
the if you like, if as a culinary student, like learning about Escoffier and that era, like to see her making those kinds of preparations is really awesome. But the bigger, more important thing is that over the course of the meal, even though the villagers have promised not to really talk about the food directly, you see this kind of like, transformation in the way that they, because they were a bickering bunch, right? Like they had a lot of like grudges and history together, but you slowly see all of this melt away over the course of the dinner until at the end, they like are walking into the street hand in hand, kind of singing a folk song or something. Right.
Yeah.
And so it has this, I don't know what you think. It's like maybe a little cheesy to a modern audience, like that transformation. But there's something really like, it's almost like they were talking about the like miracles or near miracles that the patriarch of their sect had performed. And like, to me, there was something miraculous about the meal that they shared, because it like had this really remarkable transformative effect on them.
Yeah. And I don't really think like, I think I remembered it as being more cheesy than it actually is. Like, I think that their transformation is actually like really, I mean, it was like, I kind of remembered it as, like being like more kind of the, you know, like the food is just so good that they just can't really, you know, contain themselves or control themselves, but actually they stay pretty contained and pretty controlled like throughout most of the dinner, but it just sort of like subtly changes them. Because they're just like, you know, they don't forget who they are, but they forget that they're not allowed to enjoy each other's company and enjoy, you know, life or something. You know?
Yeah.
And that like just totally changes the vibe. And then, you know, by the end, they're they remember that actually, you know, they have all lived together in this village and they all know each other and they're all friends deep down and they all, you know, their lives are all connected. And mm-hmm. it just like, yeah, it was a more subtle revelation than I kind of remembered it being. And I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. So what I really like about, another thing that I really like about the movie is that it's almost like a poem in that, like, there's a lot of like when I finished it, like, I had so many questions, like for instance, is it just the pleasure of that meal that broke down those barriers and made them loosen up, or was it something? Okay, I had 100 questions. Like, did Babette so the other kind of component of the story is that Babette spends the entirety of her lottery winnings on this supper, all 10,000 francs, right, or whatever.
Wow, good memory.
Why did she do that? Like, it seems like there's a line towards the end when she reveals that she spent all of the money from the winnings. One of the sisters is horrified and says something like, "You'll be penniless for the rest of your life," or something. And Babette says, "A true artist is never poor," or something like that. Do you remember exactly what the words are?
I think that's pretty much it, like, verbatim.
We've talked about, like, cooking as art versus cooking as craft or trade, I think, in previous conversations. So, like, she's an artist, and she spent all that money just to be able to practice her art, or, like, is it that simple? Is that the explanation, or did she do it for the village people?
I think
people?
So. Like, if you, the village people.
Sorry, not the village people.
I think that if you look at her art, like, okay, so I don't know, this is more interpretation than it is actually in the text of the movie, I think, but if you look at art as, you know, a way of touching people, or, you know, communicating with people, or making people, well, not making, but, like, yeah, I guess, like, causing people to feel a certain way or cause a reaction from people or something like that. If art is sort of, you know, like, a kind of subtle way to evoke emotions or a response in other people, and if her passion for her food is about helping people, you know, loosen up or feel some lightness, or you know, to help people just have an experience where they can kind of forget about some of their baggage for a little while and just, like, you know, feel good about having an experience or something like that. If that's like the foundation of what her art is in cooking, then yeah, I think that, you know, like, the point, if you look at it that way, kind of, is that, like, it's not that she doesn't have to be doing it every night in, you know, the best restaurant in Paris for it to be valuable, or for it to be or for it to bring her joy or anything like that. And like, you also see, like, throughout the movie, you see a lot of her like, immersing herself in their culture,
yes,
learning the language, like, learning Danish, like, over the course of, she's there for like 14 years, I think she says. So, like, there's like, during that time after Babette arrives and before the feast, you know, there's a lot of her, like, getting to know the people in the village and them getting to know her, and her learning the way that they cook and the things that they eat. And
the like, one scene that is just completely different the second time you watch it and you know her history is the scene where one of the sisters teaches her how to make, it's like an ale and bread soup. Like, it's just like, it's literally just bread and beer and not much else.
Bread, beer, water.
And so, like, when you first watch it, you're like, okay, she's learning how to make soup. But then you watch it again, you're like, okay, she's the head chef of one of the most famous restaurants in the world. And she's just patiently listening to this Danish woman explain how to make bread and ale soup. And it just, like, yeah, completely changes your viewing experience knowing her history. But
yeah, and a lot of things like that, like you just see there's also like a scene of her, which kind of starts to give it away almost a little bit, I think. Like there's a scene of her like haggling with a fishmonger.
Yes.
Where I was like, yeah, nobody haggles like with a fishmonger like a chef does. And that's like, you know. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, like there's all this like, during that time, like when she's there for 14 years and she's, you know, learning their culture and learning their food and, you know, introducing like probably little things, that little tricks that she knows to like, you know, help stretch their food, like, you know, because right, they're, you know, it's pretty, they don't have a lot. And, mm-hmm, you know, she's just like humbly sort of like injecting like her sort of skill set, I guess, or her artistry a little bit at a time into their life and just sort of like enriching their lives. And then she's sort of like afforded this opportunity to show them, you know, this, or to give them this experience, like not it's never about her, you know, like trying to show off or anything.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
about
totally
her like ingratitude trying to you know, give them something that they, give them a new experience that they maybe, mm-hmm, you know, that's maybe going to enrich them or help them, help take some of the weight out of their lives or something, mm-hmm, like that. You know, like she always feels very grateful to be there, and she never does feel poor, even though she was, you know, this great chef in Paris and then goes to this tiny religious village in Yuland, and she just, you know, she is always grateful to be there and enjoys the company of the women that she's staying with.
Yep.
And yep, is just like, you know, totally happy doing the things that she does every day, mm-hmm, you know,
yep,
and just existing and being herself. And I think that's sort of like her art or whatever.
I really liked everything it had to say about the, like the connection between food and pleasure and how, like, I don't know if it's a stereotype, but like, yeah, in my mind, it's like, yeah, there's the kind of Protestant tradition of like denying those kinds of pleasures, and then the Catholic tradition of reveling in them. That's like how it's portrayed in the movie. And that's, but it's something that I've come across in literature and stuff before. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the idea, it's like her philosophy is God wants us to eat. Like, and so he stimulates us with appetite and he rewards us with pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need to feel shame in the pleasure of enjoying these things. It's like, almost like this is how God worked it out, kind of, which is really beautiful.
Right.
Yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah. I don't know, maybe I'm way off base here, but like, I think that if you, you know, I don't necessarily know if Catholics would agree with you or something with what you just said or
right,
something. I, yep, I don't know. Yep. Like, I feel like they also, to some extent, or at least devout ones, feel like, you know, over enjoyment is also, you know, sinful or
right,
something.
Yep.
But
I mean more in the context of like the Reformation.
Right.
Like,
yeah,
so
yeah, like in the context of the time, it's probably a much more stark difference or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. So like a lot of the Protestant faiths that came out of the Reformation, like, were a reaction against, like the lifestyle of, say, like corrupt Catholic cardinals and stuff like that, who were
right,
who were extremely wealthy and could afford to buy their way out of, like, say, you know, Lenten fasting and stuff like that, and they could eat as much butter as they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so I don't necessarily mean like a Catholic and Protestant in Edmonton right now, but like, I think that that tradition of like the Reformation, like, yeah, the Reformation being a reaction against that kind of lavishness and stuff like that. We're out of our depth though. To me.
Totally.
Yeah.
I feel pretty uncomfortable talking about religion. But I'm sure both of those religions, you know, think that Satanism is probably much more about hedonism than either
right,
either of them are. Yeah, and there's actually like this really awkward moment in the movie too, where like another, in the sort of in the beginning, some suitors come to try and sort of like woo the daughters,
mm-hmm,
who I'm also, like, as a side note, not entirely sure are interested in men. Like, I don't know. I thought maybe there was, like, a little bit of subtext about that there as well. Like, you know, whether it's because they're gay or because they just have no interest in, like...
Oh, I didn't pick up on that at all.
Yeah, I don't... If it's there, it's, like, pretty deep subtext. Mm-hmm. But there were a couple things that made it kind of cross my mind. But yeah, a suitor comes to the village, and he's this French, like, he's a famous singer.
Mm-hmm.
And he hears one of the women sing in the church, and he thinks that her voice is amazing. And he wants, you know, he kind of, like, falls in love with her, and he wants to bring her back to Paris and train her
right.
how to be an operatic singer or whatever, mm-hmm. like a diva.
Mm-hmm.
And so he presents himself to the father, the preacher, and asks if if he could, give his daughter singing lessons. And the father asks him if he's...
Are you a papist?
Yeah. He asks him if he's a papist. Yeah. He says, yes, I'm a Roman Catholic. And there's this just, like, kind of awkward, like, nobody says anything. And then there's just sort of, like, this awkward silence. And then they kind of go their separate ways. It's pretty funny. Like, I think at that point, actually, he invites him inside. But yeah, it's pretty funny.
Yeah. At that point, the father's heard everything he needs to hear, kind of.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, it really, I don't know, in kind of a subtle way, really, you know, really illustrates the power of, you know, food as a shared experience. And
mm-hmm.
there's less food preparation in it than I remember. I seem to remember the food preparation part of it being, like, a really substantial part of, like the amount of time that's spent on shots of preparing food in the movie.
Right.
I thought was pretty substantial, but it's less so than I actually remembered. But
yeah, the only kind of extended cuts I can recall, like I mentioned stuffing the quails and baking the quails in the pastry.
Mm-hmm.
And you see her, like, flame the rum for the dessert, for the savarin, like the cake that she makes.
Right. Oh, yeah.
But yeah. I can't really recall much else, like, you know, details of the prep where you're like, oh, yeah, she's doing this task for this dish or whatever.
Yeah, like, they kind of show her serving the consommé. They kind of show her preparing the consommé, too. But it's just sort of like, it's never like, well, no, sometimes it is just about her being there preparing the food. But, like, there are also, like, quite a few shots where, like, she's in the kitchen and something, like, somebody comes in to talk to her about something. Like, right. one of the women comes in to talk to her about something. And, like, mm-hmm. then in the scene, she's also, like, doing some of the food prep. So it's not just, like, you know, a shot of her, you know, with her hands on the cutting board or
Rick.
Like,
yeah.
But yeah. Yeah. And there's, like, shots of her making, like, the little puff pastry sarcophagi.
Oh yeah, like cutting them out with a wine glass or quails. Something, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. 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 Made me pretty hungry watching it, actually.
Actually, I think of everything that she made, what looked the best was the blinis with the caviar and sour cream.
Oh my god. Oh yeah. Oh my god. Yeah, just, like, you know, big blinis with, like, you know, just a huge dollop of,
like, a
creme fraiche and, like, just a massive, like, probably what, like, 3 or 4 tablespoons of caviar.
Yeah,
or something.
Like a quarter cup of caviar. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's served with Veuve Clicquot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll have that. Sure.
Yeah. Me too. Oh man. Maybe one day we'll be allowed to go to a restaurant again. That would be awesome.
I guess. Oh yeah. We can't go to a restaurant. We could go individually, but we can't go. Together.
Well, yeah, I guess technically there are restaurants open again now, but yeah, I can't really go for safety reasons.
Soon enough, Shil. They're working on it.
So I've been told. Well, what if we do, like, what if we just go through the movies that were on our list of food movies, or we'll each say what we kind of, like, remember from them or what our favorite scene was. Just, like, one scene. You get to pick one scene.
Sure.
Okay.
So the only other one on my list that was in serious contention was Chef.
Okay.
And, okay, so the most memorable scene is... when the chef's, I can't even remember all the setup, but the chef storms into the dining room to rant and rave at a food critic who's eating at his restaurant.
Okay. And is this near the beginning of the movie?
Yeah. This is like what, this is how he leaves that first restaurant and then starts his, right. his journey.
And it's Jon Favreau, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And there was some, there was some kind of history with him and this critic. And I can't even remember if the critic like sent something back to the kitchen or what, but the chef marches into the dining room and tells off the critic, and a bunch of people film it, or sorry, like video it on their phones, and it kind of blows up and goes viral.
Right.
So it's a very memorable scene because I can't remember what year that movie came out, but like it was when restaurants were still, or chefs were still grappling with the idea of their, like people taking crappy pictures of their food and putting it on Google and stuff. And so like it was the element of people videoing it was something really interesting and new to me. And of course, just the idea of the chef marching into the dining room to tell someone off is just like, it's like revenge porn or something.
Yeah.
Although I think Marco Pierwaite in his autobiography, he talks about stuff like that a lot in Devil in the Kitchen. But it's always fun to watch. Although I will say, as far as a chef telling off a critic in the dining room, I actually preferred, did you ever watch Tremé? Do you know that show?
Yeah, I did. Love that show, actually.
So there's a plot line in Tremé, which is an HBO show about post-Katrina New Orleans. And there's a chef who works in a restaurant, and she's trying to serve not exactly traditional Creole and Cajun food, but like her interpretation of it, and like keep her food rooted in New Orleans. And this food critic has written off that entire cuisine. And again, I don't remember the entire build up, but she ends up going into the dining room and throwing a Sazerac cocktail in his face. And that, to me, it was just, it's just so perfect because it's like hilarious to watch. And, but yeah, the, just the fact that she's throwing.
And also poignant because it's a Sazerac.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like one of the most famous New Orleans cocktail. Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, that was a tangent. what else was on your list?
Oh man. I know I had something else on my list.
You mentioned The Big Night.
Well, I think Chef would also be on my list.
Yeah.
I think my most memorable scene from Chef is like the first time that they make medianoche, like a ham sandwich. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know why, but like, yeah, that scene. I don't know. I think it's scenes of people making sandwiches that just like really pushes my buttons or something.
I know another sandwich making scene from a movie.
Oh, really?
At the end of Kill Bill Volume 2, Bill makes a sandwich for the daughter.
For Bibi.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally remember. I can picture it. Like, yeah, I remember it clear as day.
He's using the knife like as he's talking and stuff. And, yeah.
Yeah. So Chef was also on my list. That, you know, the sandwich making scene is the scene that I remember the most for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Probably because I was hungry. I was like, oh man, that looks so good. What else was on my list? The Big Night. Right. That's the big one. Mm-hmm. So it's really like a standoff between Ratatouille and The Big Night as far as my favorite food movies go. Mm-hmm. You only get one scene though, right? Okay. So The Big Night is like their restaurant is failing, and it's these two brothers and nobody's coming, and they plan this sort of like big reopening where they're going to like change the menu from being like Italian American or, you know, to like, well, the whole movie is kind of like a fight about whether they should be doing Italian American or like the food that they were traditionally like taught how to make by their grandmother or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But they plan this big reopening and they invite Louis Prima. Somebody they know knows Louis Prima, and they put him on the guest list, and they invite all these people, and they never actually talk to him, but they're assured that he's going to show up.
Mm-hmm.
And so they plan this huge feast. And they have all these people come to the restaurant, and everyone's kind of coming there because they want to see Louis Prima.
Yeah.
But then they wound up having this amazing feast that like, yeah, just, you know, makes everybody forget about whether Louis Prima was even ever going to show up or not. And everyone just has such a great time. And, and there's some drama. But like my favorite thing, or the thing that I kind of remember the most, is I only get one. Okay, well, God, this is hard. It's been a while since I've seen it, but if I had to pick one, so they have this big feast and it's amazing and like super opulent and everyone has this amazing time. And I might be getting the order of things wrong, but they work all night to put out all this food and then they're just like exhausted. And I'm pretty sure they just like fall asleep in the kitchen.
Okay.
And then they wake up the next day and they make each other breakfast. And then they like sit down to eat it. And I don't know. It's just like very, I don't know. It's like such a, I don't know how to describe it. It's like you put all this like care and attention and all this like blood, sweat and tears and stress and drama and all these things that happen to like put on an amazing meal or put on an amazing dinner. And then, you know, things either go amazing or some things are amazing and some things are crazy and things go off the rails and you're working until like 2 a.m. But then the next day you just get up in the morning again and you come into work and you make yourself some breakfast or something. Right. And then you just do the next thing. And it's like, I don't know. It just, they really hit that feeling for me, like of, you know, living
service to service kind of.
Yeah. Kind of, you know, it's like, I don't know. It's not even, I don't know. Yeah. It's not even like service to, like, it's just like shows, even though it can be like really intense and very stressful, it's also in some ways like totally mundane, but at the same time, just like totally fulfilling, like just, you know, they have this breakfast and it's like really nourishing in the same way that the giant feast that they prepared is also nourishing,
right,
you know, like, I don't know. But like, if I can have one more, there's like a point during the feast when like they've been sitting and eating and everyone is like already stuffed. They've had like, I don't know, 5 or 6 courses already or something. And like most of the people at the table are just like, oh my God, that was such an amazing dinner. Wow. Like unforgettable. And I'm so stuffed. And then they like bring out a whole roasted suckling pig and like just like that's just like the beginning of the meal,
right?
It's just like madness. Yeah, love that moment also. Have you seen it?
No, I have not.
Man, highly recommend.
We'll seek it out. It's an old movie, or
It's like from the, well, it's probably from the 2000s or something like that. From the aughts, is that what they call it?
Some people.
Is that what we're supposed to call it?
I like it.
Did you ever watch the Kitchen Confidential TV series?
No, not a single minute, actually. Is it good?
I mean, yeah, like somewhat. I don't know. Like, I remember sort of like, I was definitely like cooking when I watched it, and I remember sort of being like back and forth about whether I liked it or not. I'm not really a big Bradley Cooper fan, and he's kind of he plays the main character slash chef, and it relies a lot on like shitty chef tropes, I think.
Yeah,
but I mean, like a lot of the circumstances and stuff are kind of like pulled from the narratives in Kitchen Confidential. So
like, is he's playing Bourdain?
Not really.
Is that like, the story? Like, his name's not Bourdain, but that's the story he's telling of like falling in love with cooking and then becoming addicted to drugs and working in kitchens in the.
Yeah, sort of. I don't exactly remember the whole storyline. But yeah, he's kind of like a fucked up chef and he's trying to run a restaurant. And yeah. And I think like a lot of the things that like some of the scenes and some of the dramas like are pulled from stories from Kitchen Confidential. And I don't know if Bourdain had anything to do with the actual series.
Okay.
But I remember it being okay. Also, have you seen Burnt?
No.
Burnt is a movie where Bradley Cooper plays a chef who's like this really supposed to be this like really amazing fine dining chef. And he like, I don't know, he's working in Paris and he's like, or no, maybe he's in London. I can't remember. Oh, shit. Yeah, I barely remember. Anyway, he like burns out hard, gets into drugs and gets into some like serious problems and has to like move out of the city where his restaurant was. And then it's about him like, you know, trying to make a comeback.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty good movie. I think like I enjoyed watching it. There was some good cooking stuff in it. There was some really good food stuff in
it. Oh, cool.
Like some pretty legit cooking in it, I think. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that last half hour of everything is probably going to get cut. So.
Yeah.
It was worth a try, though.
Yeah. Kind of. Yeah, it was a little rambly. So, yeah.
Okay, Alan. Well, I mean, we're supposed to have two topics. So.
That's the whole premise of the show.
It does feel like maybe we're going a little long, but maybe we can make a little bit of a lightning round out of the guilty pleasures topic. And then maybe we can just like... Because I built a little bit of a list of guilty pleasures, and I'm sure you probably did too. So maybe we can just kind of like quickly ramble off what our guilty pleasures are, and then maybe we can come back and try to justify them on a subsequent episode. What do you think about that?
I feel like it's a topic that needs that we need to get into.
Yeah.
So what I would like to do is I have a like it's not the big one. It's not like my truly worst guilty pleasure, but I want to share like a food guilt kind of just a little as a teaser kind of.
Okay. Yeah. Sounds good. Okay. So we're going to get into guilty pleasures, but for now, just so that we don't leave people hanging, we're going to just drop a little hint of the guilty pleasures topic.
Yeah. So what? Okay. So I just wanted, when I was going to U of A, and living in Lister Hall, I would often get a donair from Marco's Donairs in the Student Union building.
Okay.
And I would walk, I could eat it while I'm walking home. And it's like it's a donair, and then it has like kind of like the paper foil wrap, and then it's put into a plastic bag. And you eat the donair, and as you eat it, that sweet white sauce pools in the plastic bag.
Sweet sauce.
And like little bits of onion and little bits of iceberg and stuff. And I would finish the donair and I would have this bag of the white sauce and it tastes so good, especially when it has the little bits of onion and lettuce in it. I would always save it to like suck it out of the bottom of the bag, but I would like, you can't, especially like I've had a beard for all of my adult life, and like a grown man with a beard, like sucking a creamy white sauce out of the bottom of a plastic bag is not something that you can do in front of people. So I would like put the bag in my pocket and walk, like take the elevator all the way up Lister Hall, get into my room, lock the door, and I would suck the sweet sauce out of the bag.
Oh my God.
And it's not, well, I mean, I don't think anyone would be upset if you said like, oh yeah, that little extra bit of sauce. Like I love to eat that. But like, it's just like, I don't know, sucking it out of a bag. There was just something really embarrassing about it. And I had to do it. It was almost like when, you know, the story of like eating the, what are those called? The ortolans. You have to put a towel over your head so no one can see you or God can't see you. It was like that. Like I had to be alone in my room.
The what? Sorry.
Sorry. The ortolans. Do you know that? Like the bird, the little songbirds that they eat in the south of France.
No, I don't know what that is.
That's we don't have to get into it now.
Oh,
do you want to get into it now?
Sounds delicious. No, let's talk about it later.
Yeah.
I just wasn't aware of it. I don't think maybe I was, but I had kind of forgotten about it or something.
It's delicious, but you can't let any other people or God see you do it. So you have to cover your head. While you're doing it. Anyway. So yeah, the donair sauce. That's mine.
Damn, Alan. I mean, like, that definitely counts as a guilty pleasure. I don't think that it would seem as guilty a pleasure if you didn't tell me that you hoarded it in your pocket because you were embarrassed to eat it in public.
Yeah.
That part of the story is friggin' amazing. I can't believe it. Wow. That's pretty awesome. I don't know if I have anything that can even touch that. I mean, the stuff that's on my list, yeah, it doesn't even come close to anything like that. Man, I'm really going to have to, before we actually dive into this topic, I'm going to have to rethink a few things because
You mean in terms
of... I'm sure
it,
that I've got some.
Like it doesn't come... Yours don't come close just in terms of like the depravity of it? Or what do you mean?
Yeah, like... Well, in terms of... Yeah, like... Well, in terms of like the visceral illustration of the guilt that obviously you felt about doing it.
Right.
Yeah. Like, I don't... I must have some stuff like that. I'm going to have to rack my brain for it.
Okay.
The top of my list, though, is that I would say, like, I mean, definitely not frequently, but also, like, not totally infrequently, I eat Kraft dinner with hot dogs in it.
And you feel guilty about that?
I mean... Yeah, kind of. it's delicious, but like it feels like really bad food.
Yeah.
And it feels like really, I mean, you know, like we've talked in the past about like, you know, like eating a hot dog is like one of the best things ever, you know, like yep. it's delicious food and there's absolutely nothing wrong with it.
Right.
But I don't know, just like it's like the taking two convenience foods and just like smashing them together in that way. And right. It's like, yeah, feels like a guilty pleasure to me.
I think that's something when we have the full conversation, that's something that will need to be addressed, is that like things that maybe you only feel guilty about eating or serving them because you're a professional chef. Do you know what I mean? Like,
right. I think that's part of it for sure. I was going to say that actually, but I wasn't quite sure how to articulate it, but yeah, that's part of it. It like, it feels like, I guess like I have some residual sort of like,
pretension,
yeah, like chef kitchen guilt or something. Yeah. From like, you know, being in kitchens with chefs and, you know, having them judge what you eat or what you make or, you know, how you feel about certain foods or whatever. I think that I have some, like, definitely some residual types of feelings like that.
I once worked at a place where the chef owner shared a story with me where he was golfing with a very well-known Canadian chef and they had hot dogs on the course.
Rob Fien.
And...
It is?
Yes.
Oh my God.
And he swore the other golfers to secrecy. They were never to tell anyone that he ate a hot dog.
Wow, really? He felt guilty about eating a hot dog?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I guess he does have like a persona to uphold or whatever. That's fascinating. All right, well... I guess we'll get back to that topic someday.
Someday.
Maybe next episode, I guess, right?
Probably, yeah.
Can't leave it for too long.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I will, I'll definitely find something that makes me seem somewhat depraved. If I can. I mean, I'm trying to think right now. Like, there's got to be things that, like, well, actually, oh, yeah. Actually, I have a good one, and... I recently told somebody about it and they were like, what? they were kind of disgusted for me. So I'm feeling good about it. I'm going to write it on my list right now. And
I think the key is like if you're trying to think of something really embarrassing and base like that, like your mind wants to run to like, oh, like eating something out of the garbage or like something like that. But it's more important how like the guilt, what's happening inside you when you're eating it. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. Like I'm trying to think about things that I would eat when I was alone.
Yeah.
And like pretty much exclusively when I was alone. Yeah. So like, you know, there was like a lot of time and when I lived in Vancouver, when I'd be like headed home after work and it would be late or whatever. And, you know, I'd like stop by and like, and you know, pick up something, some dirt food and
yeah.
Take it home and munch on it or whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, there definitely are some things like that. I would say convenience store food is like a big one for me. Totally. Like, yeah. Anyway, we'll truly get into it.
Okay.
next episode. Food Court. Guilty Pleasures. Episode 6.
Really?
Think so.
Oh, wow. Time flies.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.